Thank you. Howdy. That's kind of weak. Yes, and I know the Rangers lost the World Series, so thank you very much for that. All right, I'm going to talk to you about some lessons. And how many of you are new to extension work, say the last 5 years or so? Okay, a few of you. Okay, well, maybe you can benefit from some of the hard lessons that I've learned over time. Well, the role of the extension specialist, and I'm going to talk about previously, and some of you may be old enough. I know my boss is. I won't say how old you are, Travis, but but you know, previously, the primary role for the extension specialist was to support county educational efforts, and we did a lot of that. We also did a lot of sort of a secondary role where we supported a lot of result demonstrations. In years past, I'm talking about many years ago, a lot of the result demonstrations were simply strip trials. There was not any replication, those kinds of things. But it answered a few questions, not very well, that some of the farmers might have had at that time. Today, though, the role, I think, for the extension specialist has changed somewhat dramatically because we're still responsible for all of those things that we have always been responsible for, but we're also being charged more and more to look for grants. Okay, can any of you identify with that? Okay, I think I'm in the right crowd then. All right, so we have additional duties and we're charged with doing more and more research. So where do we do most of our research as extension specialists? Some places, extension actually owns their own property. We have a little bit of property in College Station that we've got. It's about 80 acres, I think, Travis, is that right? Or 70, 80? That we can actually do some research on our own site. But, you know, many more times we're looking at the Ag Experiment Station sites where we either they'll allow us to have some of that property to do some research on, or we collaborate with some of the researchers and do some work there. We also do some collaborative efforts sometimes with USDA ARS people and actually conduct research on some of the federal sites. There's other state and federal agencies that get involved. Many times we wind up working with a lot of those individuals. But many, many times for extension specialists, we're using private property. And private property, it's like everything in life, there's pros and cons, okay? And so when we start looking at the pros, what are those? Well, landowners, and those of you that work for Land-Grant University, you know how generous landowners are with their property. If they find out that you are looking for a site, you'll have 10 or 12 people volunteer before you get out of a county educational event that want you to come and do something on their site. They just want to volunteer that. Not that they're necessarily interested maybe in that particular project, but they want you to have some property to work on. And so we look at private property sites are located statewide, and that gives us a lot of access to a lot of different environments. We can go from some place where it has higher rainfall to a place maybe that has less rainfall. We can go from sandy soils to maybe heavier textured soils. We can have temperature gradients or something like that. So we can work in different environments. And if we're just stuck to an experiment station, many times it's in one location or two. It may not be in all the locations that we might be interested in. And typically, working on a private property owner's place doesn't involve a lot of money, for us, that is. And what we'll do a lot of times is, as an incentive or as a help, we may try to offer them some fees if we've got some money. Say if we're going to use part of their pasture to look at some grazing work, then we may try to offer them some sort of grazing lease fee to help offset what they would typically do in their situation. Now, there are some cons associated with that, just like everything else. And the first one is lack of control. Because as I'll go through some case studies here in a little bit, you'll see there can be some horror stories out there if you're not real, real careful in how you handle these. Oh, I'm sorry, I must have had that in there twice. Or maybe it's in there three times. You know, real estate, you know, they talk about everything depending on location, location, location. This is the primary downside to working on private property. Having said that, I have had some horror stories on Ag Experiment Station lands, you know, so I won't say it always just happens on private property, but it seems like these things do happen more frequently on private property. I want to take you through a few heartbreaking case studies that we had. The first one here was a project. It was it actually wound up being a four-year SARE-funded project on farm research. And we're going to test the viability of two different wintering systems for grazing beef cattle. We were going to look at using some stockpile Bermuda grass plus rye grass versus traditional hay-only feeding. And we had two locations identified, two very willing producers that were wanting to work with us very much. And so the problem that we encountered is that one of the producers looked over on her hay-only cattle herd. She decided that the ryegrass looked mighty, mighty tempting. And so without our knowledge, and several weeks before we were ready to turn the other set of cattle in there, she turned in her hay-only cattle onto the ryegrass because she thought it might minimize some of her feeding costs associated with hay. And so the downside, I guess the bottom line of that was we had to terminate that particular location. Now, the upside is the other site, actually, we had very good success with that site. And we're able to complete a four-year study where we actually generated some very, very good data off of that site. So, you know, it's not all gloom and doom, but in this particular case, this particular individual run that part of it for us. Number two, I did a lot of herbicide efficacy studies and those kinds of things. And we have a plant over in Texas called McCartney Rose. It's an import. They brought it into South Texas many, many years ago as a living fence, and it does a really good job as a living fence. The problem with McCartney Rose is it doesn't stay where you put it, and so it has expanded its range over a lot of South and East Texas. So we're always looking for something to try to control or manage this particular problem brush species with. So we go out and we evaluate this. We put out a bunch of trials, a bunch of treatments. So it's all replicated. And you can see what that plant looked like in that previous picture. It looked brown, it looked dead. And so the landowner's hired hands came along one day and said, well, you know, all those things are dead. Let's just set fire to them. So one of the things we do with brush, we always evaluate it 12 months after treatment, and then another time 24 months after treatment. And so at 10 months into the trial, they had already burned it up. And we just happened to go by there one day and saw that all of the plots were burned up. And it was kind of disheartening because we had put a lot of effort into that. And so as you can imagine, that particular project was also terminated. And again, it was heartbreaking because we had 16 different treatments that were replicated out there. And we were 10 months into that. Just two more months, let us get our evaluation. But the hired hands tried to help us out of that. And so we lost that study. Another one, we're looking at mesquite. I don't know, a lot of people don't see mesquite in California. You might see a little bit of it here. Certainly across the southern tier of the southwestern states, you can see some. And mesquite has become a pretty invasive problem in a lot of our rangeland areas. And so we're always looking at different herbicides to see if we can manage these mesquite problems. It's usually regrowth mesquite because a lot of our producers think the way to handle mesquite is to mow it or shred it. And of course, that removes the apical dominance, it activates the bud zone, and then instead of a single stem plant, now we have multi-stem plants that are taking over the rangeland. So we had several very good treatments out on this. We're seeing some very interesting things. And it was a three-year project, and on the plot plan, it's plainly stated 3 years, and in year one we would do this, and year two, year three. And of course, they went out there and sprayed with another herbicide the second year, confounding our results on that. And so again, we had to terminate that particular project. Case study number four, and this is kind of an interesting one. We were looking on some of the stands in East Texas where we've grown Bermuda grass for many, many years. We're starting to see some stands are declining, and we think some potassium issues are there. And so we were looking at different rates of potassium, fall applied versus spring applied, and that sort of thing. Well, you can see what it looked like in that producer's field. And the problem was that our larger plots looked so good, he decided to harvest those for hay himself. And so we lost the yield data off of that. And again, it confounded what we did get out of that. And so we didn't get much out of that particular project. Final case study here is another herbicide study that we put out on Wesatch. And we were doing we had a different protocol here. We were using simply pasture weed weed application rates of herbicides and seeing if we went over this regrowth brush, if we did that 3 years in a row, could we manage that brush? Could we suppress it? Could we actually kill it? Instead of spending $60 to $70 an acre for actual brush control, if we just sprayed the weeds and went over the top of some of this regrowth weed thatch, how would that work? And we were within 2 weeks of making our third year application. We were within 2 weeks of getting our third year evaluation. And of course, they went in there and shredded everything. And so, again, we lost what I think could have been a really good study. So a lot of these herbicide studies, you know, I guess they call it search and research, you know, for a reason. So we have to start over. I found this slide. It was a set of slides I was looking through the other day. It was really interesting. We were involved in an ag agent training session several years ago, and there was somebody that was making a presentation to the county agents about on-farm research. And he said, don't forget about the landowner. He said, don't forget the landowner, because the uninformed landowner has probably wrecked as many or more demonstrations as has the weather. And I was looking at that slide and I said, gosh, who was that brilliant person that said that? Well, it was me. You know, and you'd have thought that I would have learned from my own, you know, exhortations to the county agents, but we continue to have some problems. And so the question is, when we look at, you know, all these failed case studies that we've had, and we've had some successes. I don't want to paint it all as black and gloomy, but, you know, if you look and say, okay, whose problem or who was at fault here? And, you know, I have to take the blame for that, because in every case there was some sort of a failure to communicate appropriately. And our previous speaker pointed that out, that it's all about communication and communication and even more communication so that we can keep these producers in the loop. The communication problems are, I guess there are many, but I sort of boiled them down to just a couple. A lot of times we'll be at a county educational event, and the county agent may know that you're interested in looking for a site to do some sort of a project on. Or you may be at a meeting and find out that they actually have some problem that they would like for you to come and address. And so a lot of times we just discuss this at the meeting, almost in passing. You know, we're making a presentation, they're sitting in the audience, and we're going home and say, hey, yeah, by the way, that'll be fine. Won't you do that project on my place, and everything's fine. A lot of times you don't get much more communication than that for various reasons. We're on the go a lot. A lot of landowners are on the go a lot. And a lot of times there's not a lot of opportunity for a lot of discussion. But another issue, I guess, is depending solely or heavily on the county agent to really carry the ball for you. County agents want to be involved, and they should be involved in those on-farm research projects. But have you ever seen that, that's that little game right there where you start whispering something in somebody's ear, and you see after it makes the whole circle, what does it sound like? It doesn't sound like anything like you started, okay? And so if you get too many people in the mix there, you'll tell the county agent, here's what we'd like to do. He repeats that to somebody else, and that's repeated to somebody else. And before you know it, the project doesn't look anything like what you thought it was going to turn out to be. So the failure to fully engage the landowner at all phases of the project, I think, is one of the biggest issues, and it just stems from a lack of communication. So if I ever conduct on-farm research again, and I say that somewhat facetiously, because we're always interested and always happy to go and do projects on these private properties, I'm going to engage. I'm going to make sure I have a checklist here that I'm going to engage in more effective communication with the landowner. And I think that's key. Previous speaker, again, went over that several times. But I'm going to start with the site visit. I may have a phone call. I may find out about a producer that says, yes, he has this problem that we need to address on his place, or he wants you to come and just use his property if it's a fertility trial or something like that. So I want to make a site visit. I want to visit with that gentleman or that lady out in the field. And I want to stand out there and really try to help them get an idea of just what it is that we're trying to do. If it's a particular weed out there on the landscape, let's go identify that weed. Let's point that out. Let's talk about the growth habit of that plant, what it's doing. Is it toxic? Let's talk about some of those things. The communication will then continue at the kitchen table. Because if this landowner says, yeah, I understand what you're talking about, I want to go sit down with the landowner now, and that's where the plot plan is going to come out, and we're going to carefully go over that plot plan, because I want him to fully understand. Because again, if we're just envisioning out there in the field, he may have a pretty good grasp. He may understand better than I do. But I want to sit down with him with a plot plan then and say, okay, here's the way this is going to look, and this is what we intend to do, because I want them to be fully engaged in this. Now, if the landowner agrees in principle, we've stood in the field and we've talked about it. We've sat down at the kitchen table. We've talked about it. And he's in full agreement that we're going to be able to come and do this trial. Then I'm going to move to the next stage, what I call a delivery of the contract. Okay? Now, that contract doesn't, we're not talking about a legal document. We're not talking about a binding document. We're not talking about something they even have to sign, although that's probably not a bad idea for everybody to sign off that I have read this paper and understand what I'm signing. But this contract's going to be a written document that, again, has a copy of the plot plan attached to it. It's going to have a simple but carefully worded protocol, because I think that's really important. A lot of times as scientists or whatever, sometimes we put stuff down on paper that may be really clear to us, but it may not have any meaning, or it may actually send somebody that doesn't work with that a lot into the wrong direction. So I think we need to have a very, very simple but carefully worded protocol. I want to emphasize the timeline, because this is where we get in a lot of trouble in a lot of our on-farm research projects, because we'll say, yeah, we're going to do this. They may even be out there helping us. But if they don't understand that we're coming back next year and we're going to do the same thing, this is a three-year project, and we're going to repeat these treatments 3 years in a row. If they don't understand that, it's kind of like that mesquite control project. We get all those treatments out. Everything's replicated. And then at the end of the year, they think it's over with. They see a few plants that are defoliated. They think it's over with, and they're through. I want to describe the activities that will occur at the various times during that project. This goes along with that timeline. If it's April that we plan to come out and fertilize, I want to spell that out. I want to spell out how much fertilizer we're going to put out. And if we're going to make a second application in June, I want to spell that out. I want them to understand that very carefully. I want to include reminders of activities that will confound the study, because a lot of times, if we're not careful to really lay these out and help them understand this particular piece of property over here, if you do anything like add insecticide, herbicide, fertilizer, if you harvest it in any manner with an animal or mechanically harvesting that property, you're going to confound our study, and we won't be able to use that data. And so I want them to understand that, you know, a lot of times they go out and they say, oh, shoot, I'm just out here. I'll go and fertilize their plots too. And they're thinking they're being helpful. But we want them to understand that there are certain aspects or certain activities that we really don't want them involved in or taking place on that. So at the trial initiation, we're going to involve the landowner. A lot of landowners like to be out there on the tractor or, you know, whatever. Now, they don't necessarily have to be. But I want the landowner out there. I want him to see. He doesn't have to stay all day, but I want him to see where we're laying things out, what it's going to look like as we lay this study out on his piece of property, and where that's going to take place. Now, we've already sort of done that generally, but I want him to actually see what the boundaries are going to look like. I want to mark those boundaries, and I'm learning the hard way. I had a large field trial in the middle of a hay field that had the corners marked with T-post. And 2 years running, they mowed the T-post with a shredder. I'd go out there and find them all twisted up in the ground. And I wonder, how can they run over a T-post? So I think signage really has to come into this, because I want to say, okay, here's the boundaries. And I want to actually put some signs up that it doesn't have to say no entry, but I want them to understand this is the study site. Okay, and I want them to understand that inside that area, now this is where you have to be sort of a diplomat, because what you're saying in essence is, sir, thank you for this property. You no longer own it for the next 3 years. It belongs to me. But you can't come out and say that. So you have to sort of come around, sneak in the back door, and let them understand that this particular piece of property, we're gonna define the boundaries, we're gonna put some signs up. And inside that area, that's a no-go area. No-go. No one goes in there. Nobody puts herbicide. Nobody puts insecticide. Nobody puts anything in there. We're not going to harvest it. I don't care if it grows up and I don't care if it looks terrible. Just leave it stand until we get out here and take care of it, okay? So we're going to go over the plot plan again. And I'm talking about repetition because I think repetition is very, very important at keeping that landowner familiar with what's going on, showing inclusiveness for him. During the trial, we're going to regularly visit the site. We're not just going to give him a phone call. We're going to go out there and get with him and go out there and look, revisit the contract. Talk about it again. Say, okay, here's where we are on the timeline, and here's the treatments that we've applied already, and here's when we're fixing to do the next treatment. Maybe next spring, maybe next fall, but we want to go over that. We want to keep the landowner in the loop, and if there's any changes, talk about things that happen. If there's something that we decide, oh, we need to change that or maybe add to or something, we're going to create a new contract. We're going to sit down again with them, make sure that they understand the changes that have taken place out there. At the trial conclusion, we're going to go back to the site. We're going to indicate to the landowner that, yes, the project is complete. We're going to take down our boundary markers. We're going to take down our signs and all that sort of thing. We're going to share data with him. And I think one of the important things is that we talked about briefly earlier is to sort of try to indicate to them, what does that data mean? What does that data really mean? Does that mean that if you adopt this practice, that all your worries are over? That you're going to get wealthy doing whatever it is you're doing? Probably not. But if there's something there that can help them, if it provides another tool for them to put in their toolkit that they can use that they formerly didn't know about, something that maybe it's a new chemical, a new herbicide that they didn't understand that they could use, didn't know what's on the market, or if it's a different fertility treatment. Whatever it is, we want to try to help them understand in simple terms, and I thought that was great a while ago, the randomization and the replication. I think those are pretty easy concepts for these landowners to understand because we discussed earlier, they understand the vagaries of weather. They understand that one year they're going to have a great yield and next year it may not be so good because of the weather. So we can explain, I think, in terms of them. We don't want to be caught up in some of these things I've seen before, like strip trials, and go out there and try to make an inference that, yeah, this side of the field did better than this side of the field, so I'm going to do what this was over here. That's not very good data, and we don't want to share that kind of data with them. So in summary, I think the on-farm research offers a lot of opportunities for us because, again, there is a lot of variability to these different landowner properties that we can go out and find a place. If we want a sandy site versus a clay site, we can do that with on-farm research. It does offer some challenges, okay? It does offer some challenges trying to keep the landowner from confounding the study. And I think that really just very effective communication is the key to that because the more we have them included, the more we have them in the loop, the more that they're going to understand that, okay, that area I'm not going to tamper with. Even though they want to and help us, they want to go in there and shred or, you know, whatever they want to do, try to help us, we need to help them understand that those things are not, they're not helpful in the long run. The on-farm research can provide needed scientific data. It can provide us with information that we can publish in journal articles, okay? If it's conducted right, we certainly can do that. It strengthens, I think, and I think the Nebraska model shows that. It really strengthens that extension clientele relationship. You can build a great relationship, and then when times are a little bad, maybe for the university or for extension, we've got a cadre of friends out there that maybe can go to the legislature sometimes and help us. It also provides that back to the old result demonstration leading to the regional adoption of BMPs because if I can do it on somebody's farm and I can demonstrate something there under in a on-farm research trial, that's the same thing to the county agent or to the farmer as a result demonstration. And those people that come to the field day or those people that are looking over the fence and seeing what the farmer is doing and what they adopt, they can help us sell a whole lot more technology or transfer a lot more technology sometimes than we can with our fact sheets and with our internet and that sort of thing. So with that, if you see any of this anywhere that you can share with us, we're awfully dry back in College Station. We would be real grateful if you'd send some our way. Thank you.
We do have about 5 minutes for questions or comments or discussion amongst the group.
Yes, sir.
Sometimes you mentioned that you have to discuss the final data with the farmer. So I have one kind of experience in Michigan, because they don't understand that how much time we need to spare for the soil analysis and other things. So they need immediate.
Right. Right.
Because they cannot understand. So, and I need to wait until I get publication or something like that.
Right, right.
How can I make up that gap? They need immediate, and we cannot really supply it because there's a lot of what we need.
Right. Oh, I think you're exactly right. I think property owners are wanting to know right now. You know, in the research game, you know, we say, well, if we just had another 10 years and another grant, I think we could really get the information. I think when we do these trials, and I'm not happy with a 1 year or 2 year data set. If I have a 3 year trial and the landowner's working with me, and I want him to understand, 1 year of data is not going to be the answer. 2 years, 3 years is not really the answer. But I get a feeling there, I get a strong sense if the data suggests that, and the analysis of that data suggests it, that before I get it published, I can still share with that producer that, you know, it looks like if we were to apply a little bit of potassium in the fall before this Bermuda grass goes dormant, that might lead to a better yield next year based on our 3 years of data. I don't mind sharing that before it's published, because I've got the data in hand. And I feel pretty confident about that. So, yeah, I'm not going to share too much with them the first couple of years, but at the end of the trial, whatever that trial is, I want to share with them, and I want them to understand that is it going to make them, you know, $5, $10, $100 more profit? It may not be about the profitability. It may be more about persistence or long-term, you know, persistence of a stand of grass or something like that. So it may not be something they can get a dollar value out of right now, but it may certainly help them in the future. Question.
How do you deal with producers that say, "Oh, I know what's going on. Don't worry about it. Just contact me."
Right.
Results were in terms of communication.
I think, you know, you have to develop relationships. You know, that's what it's all about, is relationships. And so I think we just have to, and we don't want to make a pest of ourselves, but I think the more frequently that you maybe drop by or give them a phone call or something like that, if you can start to develop more of a relationship there, then I think they're more accepting of that. And they actually, and if you ever show them something the first year, if they ever see something out there, like if you see a dead weed out there in the pasture, a lot of times they get pretty excited about that. So now they're out there kicking around with you and looking. And so I think it just takes time to develop that relationship. We did a study on the Board of Regent member's place one time, and he knew good and well that he knew the answer to the issue, and we knew good and well that he didn't. And we thought that a good demonstration project would be to do this on the Board of Regent member. And he was out there every time that we went, and we got him to think a little differently about his soil fertility needs after we got through with that project. So I think it's just about relationships. Yes, sir.
I'm really positive on your communication thing. We see that happen as well, and it, you know, reinforces in us that we need to do a better job communicating. One of the problems, though, is that these farms get bigger and they employ other than the farmer.
Yeah, yeah.
Keeping the whole process up to speed.
Right. And see, in my world, I usually am not faced with that. But if I was faced with that, let's say I'm going to go to a ranch, it's 15,000 acres, guy's got 10 cowboys working there. I'm going to get all the cowboys to come. We're going to all meet at one time in the field, and then we're going to all go sit down at the kitchen table too. Because I want those boys included also, because you're exactly right. The landowner can have every understanding and every best intention, but if that doesn't get translated or transmitted out to the guys in the field, the same thing can happen exactly. So it's got to be inclusive. Everybody that's going to be running a tractor or a spreader or running cattle, putting cattle places, it's got to include everybody.
I just would suggest that's hard to do sometimes.
Yeah, I agree.
They've got people spread out, and they're not willing. You know, they're paying those people. They're
right.
Not willing to bring them on.
Right.
And say, okay, we need to sit down and talk about this.
Yeah, and that's part of that planning process. You know, if you just show up, and say, "Hey, why don't you go get all your cowboys?" Well, you know, it ain't going to happen. But if you say, hey, I'd like to come out, tell me a time that we could all sit down and talk about this, I think we can plan around that. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.